ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage that part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Refidex, Melways, UBD, I don't know what you called yours, but that book of maps that used to live behind the passenger seat of every car is basically a relic now. They remind me of the great weight of responsibility of navigating when I was younger. These days, I'm very glad of the relative ease of maps on my smartphone, which calculate tolls and monitor traffic and predict my ETA to the minute. But what do we lose when navigating for ourselves takes a backseat? That's in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, one of the oldest books on witch hunting from 1494 is heading to Australia. 500 years on, it's an insight into how easily harmful ideas can take hold. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, the word Luddite used to be an insult. The idea that you were backwards or technologically illiterate, resistant to progress. Now it's a term that's almost worn like a badge of honour. Like, no thank you, I'm happy not being fed constant pinging updates on the news or getting sucked into rage bait comment sections or falling down a TikTok rabbit hole only to discover that the sun has long set and I've completely forgotten to start cooking dinner. Maybe we wonder, were we all better off without our phones? Well, the desire for a return to the offline world has led a group of people to organise the Summer of Ludd Festival in New York City. The festival took place last month in the spirit of the original Luddites of the 1810s, who were textile workers that resisted early forms of automation. The Festival of Ludd held events all over the city to promote human connection and learning, all while being phone-free. And New York is a long way away, but the appeal of disconnecting is arguably global, and maybe you've tried something like this too. You're about to hear from the festival's spokes puppet. You heard me right, I'll explain it in a minute, as well as our favourite sociologist. But I want to hear from you as well. How do you bring parts of your pre-tech, non-digital life into the now? Do you only use your landline on a Sunday, or do you read a book on your commute instead of scrolling? Have you found a way to embrace your inner Luddite somehow? Give me a call on a landline if you must. Tell me what disconnecting has looked like for you. Joining me from New York is Gowanus, the media spokes puppet for the Summer of Ludd. Gowanus, you're my first ever puppet guest on Life Matters. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Tegan. Good morning, Australia.
Good morning to us. Good evening to you. Gowanus, for people who can't see you, you are a puppet made of a sock and old carpet offcuts and t-shirt buttons. Why?
And a few bottle caps, yes. I am a puppet made out of garbage found outside of a thrift store in Gowanus, Brooklyn. I'm about 6 months old. I was made in January of this year.
Well, you're very articulate for someone so young. Tell me about the Summer of Ludd Festival.
Sure. So I have been appointed to represent many, many organizers from around New York City and the rest of America who just put on an 8-day festival called the Summer of Ludd. There were over 120 events through 8 days, and every event was free, public, and participatory.
What did that look like in practice? How did you actually tell people what was happening if you couldn't use the internet?
Great question. So this was really an experiment in seeing how much we could organize these activities without using big tech. So a modern day Luddite is one who is much in the tradition of the Luddites of the 1800s, a worker movement that started in England. We are resisting where tech overreaches into our personal lives. The original Luddites said that they were resisting technology or machines that was harmful to commonality. So we believe that today the machines that are most harmful to commonality are addicting platforms like Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, smartphones that extract a lot of data and turn it into commodified resources for businesses to make money off of the time you spend on your screens. And we wanted to plan this festival without using that. So we did not use any social media. We used printed guidebooks. We printed over 15,000 schedule booklets that we put in bookstores, record shops, cafes, community centers, parks around the city. We did a large poster campaign around New York. And we relied very heavily on word of mouth and, most of all, the openness of strangers on the streets. The majority of events were held in Tompkins Square Park, and we invited anyone who was passing by to be a part of the different activities that we were doing.
It's funny you really articulated the parts of the Luddite movement that most resonated with you. We've got a text here from Sophie who says, it was the effects of the introduction of the machinery on the lives of people. That's what it was all about. The very poor quality of the fabric that the mills produced, autonomy taken from the farmers to live in their own houses, to have a cow, pigs, chickens, to grow food, to work, to spin and weave. Those people were forced to go to cities to live in disgusting conditions and be forced to work in horrible and dangerous conditions. Not just a hatred of machinery. Gowanus, is Sophie hitting the nail on the head for you?
Yeah, Sophie, that's great. Great historical context. And, you know, a lot of original Luddites were skilled artisans themselves who really knew these machines in and out. What they were fighting against was the effects that it was having on their personal lives, on the workforce, on the sort of economic sort of, you know, downstream effects of forcing these new machines into the workplace without real worker consent. So yeah, I think that's great. And in a similar way, you know, we're not just blindly anti-technology in 2026. Much like you were saying in your introduction, we are interested in creating spaces for people to just live differently so they're not always on the phone, always doing the same thing all the time. We want to create more space for people to have more control over their days.
We're talking about the upsides of being a Luddite here this morning on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Gowanus, spokespuppet for the Summer of Ludd Festival in New York City, which has just wrapped up. And I'm asking you to tell me how you've managed to bring a bit of offlineness into your 2026 life. Also here with me is a sociologist who will be familiar to you, Professor Dan Woodman from the University of Melbourne. Dan usually joins me fortnightly to talk about social things, but we've pulled him out of the cupboard today on a Wednesday to talk about the Luddite Festival. Dan, what do you reckon about this idea of the Summer of Ludd?
Good morning, Tegan, and good morning, Gowanus. Like you, Tegan, this is my first time on air with a puppet, and it's very exciting.
Setting a very high bar. What do you reckon about this idea of coming together for our offline activities?
It's really interesting, and it resonates with what we hear in my own research. So I do a study where we track a big group of young Australians as they go through their 20s. And this wanting to disconnect, but also more importantly, the wanting to disconnect off, reconnect offline, get together with people is something that really comes through when we talk to and we survey our participants. It's not that everyone's like your last caller throwing their smartphone fully in the bin and getting offline, but they are worried about maybe losing the opportunities to do it, but also potentially some of the capacities and skills to share space with people. So what we hear a lot is that it gets too hard to organize time together. Like our mobile phones have helped us get together on the one hand, but we live these messy, individualized lives where there's not times and spaces where you know people are going to be available. And when you do organize to go out or go to an event offline, people often cancel on you at the last moment. So I love an event that was organized as well using posters instead of LinkedIn to tell people where it's happening. So I think a Summer of Light would probably resonate really well down here in Australia as well.
Yeah, good point. Maybe when summer rolls around. Tony, we've got you back. What Luddite traits have you embraced?
Well, I don't know. I just get on the metro and I find someone that's not on their phone, which is like one out of 15 people maybe, and just start talking to them. Just say, hey, congratulations for not being on your phone. That's a good excuse. There's a good excuse to start the chat. And they're quite happy. They love it. I think people want to talk. They're just scared, just in case the other person says, oh, what are you doing? You know, what are you trying to talk to me for? So that's what I do. And I have some good conversations and... you know, it doesn't go any further than that, but I just enjoy talking to people.
Love a bit of casual banter on the metro. Tony, thank you so much for the call. Gowanus, talking more specifically, what kind of activities were people doing once they figured out how to get to the Summer of Light and take part?
So like I said before, we had over 120 pre-planned events that involved teach-ins, workshops, seminars about attention, about clowning, about how to mend your own clothes, about how to set up event calendars in print or online away from big tech, away from companies that steal your data and that are a lot safer and that respect your privacy. We had all-night parties with no phones in sight. We had parades across the city where we danced around and sang. And there were a lot of improvised events as well, a lot of spontaneous happenings that weren't even planned in advance, which I think really plays into Dan's point here, that people are, you know, deep down craving these moments of spontaneous connection, but we just have to do a lot of work to set up the conditions for that to happen. So when you get a group of excited people together in the park who are smiling at each other, who are saying hello, who are going up to a stranger if they have their phone out and saying, hey, would you like to join us instead? You get such a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful display.
Were you surprised at which sessions were more popular?
We had great turnout throughout the 8 days. We actually had a record-breaking heat wave in New York City. It was over 105 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in Celsius.
That sounds horrible in Celsius, officially.
It was very, very hot. It's the summer here. And
oh my gosh, that's 40 degrees. That, oh my gosh, Gowanus, you poor thing. You must have been so sweaty in your carpet suit.
I didn't even know a puppet could sweat this much. But we had so many people come despite that. There were over thousands during the week that engaged with all of the events. And yeah, I was surprised to see how many people stuck around for multiple days. That's what I would say. They met friends when they first found us in the park. And then they kept coming back together, almost like a summer camp, how you kind of find like a group of friends at summer camp. And one other thing I wanted to say is people weren't just from New York. We actually had Australians with us who were visiting and happened upon the festival. And some of my Luddite friends went to Australia last summer in December. And they were doing some research around the social media ban that went into effect for young people in Australia. And they saw that while that ban, you know, has a lot of things to be worked out, it seems like a very complicated political situation. At the end of the day, all these people in Australia are feeling similarly. They want to spend less time online and they want to find each other out in public spaces. What? And they told me that the trains were beautiful. People are on the trains with no shoes in Sydney during the summer. And there's free payphones all over. So Australia sounds like it already has a lot of great infrastructure in place for people to have a kind of event like this. And it's just a matter of the people coming together.
Well, it's definitely the theme today coming through from you listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. You're trying to call me. The phones aren't playing, but we're going to try again. You're also sending me texts. Colin from Canberra says, my wife said to tell you, she's not a Luddite, she's a techno peasant, which sounds like a good time and with a good beat. Gary, we're going to try to talk to you about how you take a Luddite approach to driving. Tell me about it.
Oh, good morning. Yes, I have two early model Holdens. They have manual gearboxes. They don't have any power steering. They don't have air conditioning. They have old-fashioned drum brakes, and they're more like driving a light truck than a modern car. All the clocks in my house are wound with a key, and I'm talking to you on a landline.
That is a real commitment, Gary. Thank you so much for the call. Danny is also a road Luddite. Danny, tell me about it.
Yes, I own a 1957 Series 1 Land Rover and a 73 Combi camper. The ECU is my brain, the cup holder's my hand, and the control's my right leg. I repurpose tools. I've got a collection of my dad's tools I take camping. I keep things simple. I'm not completely anti-technology. We have to embrace Starlink, unfortunately. Otherwise, where we live is just, there's just nothing.
Yeah.
I love it. It's people, they're all got lap belts, or the Combi doesn't, but the Land Rover does because it's pre-69, doesn't have to have like sash belts, but and there's nowhere to put the upper mount anyway. And my work colleagues tell me I'm mad driving these cars because they're so dangerous, but I enjoy them. They drive around in their iPads, you know.
Danny, thank you so much for the call. Danny and Gary both sound like they have very strong upper body limbs from all that like lack of power steering. You're telling me how you've embraced a Luddite-ish life on ABC Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It's not all roses. Helen, you've got a Luddite friend, but it's put some stress on the friendship.
Yes, at worst, at best, it frustrates me, and at worst, makes me feel paranoid. Even her home phone voices over a message saying, this mobile doesn't take message. Even the mobile gives that message as well. It's impossible to contact her to make rearrangements, and I end up feeling very angry and frustrated with her. She just refuses to understand what the phone is about, and that's even drifted into her home phone.
That's really interesting, Helen. Have you talked about this with her?
Yes, and she even says, I haven't received a message from you. And I end up yelling at her, but your phone doesn't take messages and you don't understand and you won't read or understand text.
Okay, that's a really interesting perspective, Helen. Thank you so much for that. Dan, is there a sense that we actually do kind of need to keep with the times, that there's an expectation if we're going to be in society that we need to participate a little bit?
Yeah, so when I was growing up, I had a phone in my family home that was stuck to the wall and I had to share it with all my family and they could hear me speaking with whoever I was calling and it was not a good way to organise a social life or a dating life. The callers now, like they're speaking about cars and other things, reminds me that, like, as new technologies have come about over time, there's always been, I guess, a countercultural social movement of some sort that's raised in response. So even with the motor car, there were some people who were really into the horses and carts, and it's probably good that we didn't stick with the horses and carts, but a little bit like the Luddites, they weren't just anti-technology. They wanted safety and they wanted proper infrastructure. We probably live in a world with safer cars and things like the seatbelts that actually keep you in your seat through those social movements. So these ways of living differently, even if they don't mean that we return to the past, and I don't think the Summer of Ludd really does want to return us to the past, but they're asking important questions about how we might live better, even alongside these new technologies.
Well, Sarah tried to call me before. We've got you back on the phone now, Sarah. You want your kids to be Luddites. Tell me about that.
Oh, it's something that's so important to me, Tegan, and I think most good parents out there probably feel similarly. The terrible rise in mental health problems and emotional problems and depression and anxiety among children and teenagers these days is directly linked to screen use and excessive time using technology. And so I try very hard with my children and teenagers to keep them off screens and to give them the sort of wonderful childhood that I had.
What kind of reaction do you get from your kids to that, Sarah?
Well, they resist it, of course. But I think they understand, and I think for the most part, they really enjoy the time that they spend outside and reading and doing just all those nice things face to face that we used to do as children and as teenagers. It makes me really sad, Tegan, when I drive past a bus stop and I see all these kids just with their heads down staring at phones. Mm. It makes me sad when I see children sitting inside slumped over iPads and computers and their phones, not playing sport or just being outside or just being with other kids face to face. And the other thing that I think is really important is that we spend screens and technology fill children's lives so much so that every moment they're stimulated and they don't have time to let their minds wander. And just that's why I'm always saying to my kids when we're on a long drive or if you're on the bus, just look out the window, let your mind empty, let your mind wander and daydream. You don't always need to be peering at a tiny screen, filling your mind with information that you don't always need.
Sarah, such a good point. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Goannis, it's interesting, Sarah, talking there about sort of the power of boredom. Is that something that you've explored?
Yeah, that's great. All of these people are so smart. Thank you, everyone. It had me thinking about how the Summer of Love Festival had people from age 7 to 70 years old throughout very consistently. It was not just one age group that was sort of building this culture together. And in that way, it very much feels like we're trying to move forward in a safer way and not move back into some nostalgic period of time, right? And part of that will look like having our own social norms and maybe even some technologies that help us sort of let our minds wander more and find beauty and excitement in having our attention go wherever it wants to naturally. I think it can be a very creative and inspiring thing to just like learn to trust your mind in the kind of quiet moments. And we looked into that a little bit throughout our programming. We had meditation every morning. We had something called an attention activism event, which is inspired by the School of Radical Attention, a nonprofit here in New York. And they think a lot about this kind of thing. How, regardless of what phone you use, regardless of where you are in your journey with technology, we can all get together and exercise our minds in different ways.
Pete's called in with maybe a bit of a practical demonstration of finding this balance between using tech and not. Pete, tell me your story.
Yeah, so I actually work in media and marketing and, you know, I spend a lot of time with tech and I'm having to use AI and all that kind of stuff now. But in my personal life, I switched over to a dumb phone. Mm. So I did that for about 6 months, didn't have anything except being able to call and text. That was a little hard. So now I've got a halfway option, which doesn't have any social media or anything like that, but I can still, you know, use a couple of messaging apps and things like that. So, yeah, and that's been really good at sort of breaking that thing where you just, you know, automatically got to reach your phone if there's like a dull moment or something. So
tech in the streets and dumb phone in the sheets or something.
Something like that. But yeah, it's actually made a huge difference. So often I'm just leaving my phone in like another room or something, and it's just kind of, I'll use it if I need to actually get in contact with someone, but it's not like that sort of go-to, which is really nice. So
thanks so much, Pete, for that. Dan, I'm interested, we heard Goannis say before this idea about social norms. We've got Pete here kind of figuring out where the tech belongs in his life and where it doesn't belong. Do you think we'll develop like etiquette around when it's okay to be plugged into your phone and when it's not?
Yeah, I think so. So I was really interested to hear about this not-for-profit in New York around attention, because I think about how we attend to the world and to other people is something where we're negotiating the new social norms. Because one of the things we do like about our phones or headphones that we can put on is that sometimes we don't want to talk to the stranger on the train, and that's important to us too. But there is, I think, an issue emerging in how we pay attention to the world around us, including others in it. I know for myself, a year and a half back, I deleted the social media apps off my phone because I felt they were dragging me in too often. And I think it does help me attend to the world around me a little bit more. But I made sure that I still had on the phone and still have plenty of time for the ABC Listen app when I want to get off from interacting with the world as well. So I think it will be about us our finding our own balances, but also that kind of those social norms and also the kind of social world or infrastructure we build that gives us opportunities to meet with other people, but also build the skills to use that time well, I guess, to build what we call community in different ways.
I'm similar to you, Dan. I uninstalled the social media apps from my phone about a year ago now, and I think I've read more books in the past year than I read in the five years previous, and I love reading. I just have more time for it now. Go on.
It's absolutely coming through in the conversations,
My literariness. Go on. I know that you're like a fully actualized sock puppet and you already had all this stuff on lock, but has participating in the festival shaped your own approach to technology?
Absolutely. So one thing that came to mind while Dan was speaking is that this movement didn't start right when the phone or social media was introduced, right? It's been 10, 20 years in some cases. And we're only now starting to renegotiate our norms. And what I've been thinking about lately is this idea of center of gravity. That really what we're trying to do is bring people's center of gravity for their attention and their social lives back into the public, back into their neighborhoods and the cities that they live in. And in that way, it makes me feel like the technology that I do use, like the computer that I emailed you from to set this up, it feels more like a tool, like an extension of the social life that I'm already living, right? And I think in a very similar way to you all in deleting the social media apps from your phones, all of the Luddites here in New York are constantly looking for more ways to move along this journey, because it's a never-ending sort of project, I think, to keep immersing yourself more and more in the beautiful experiences that are out there to be had. And it's really no one particular person's fault. Mm. It can be really easy to feel like you're addicted and you're struggling and you have to get off your phone. But this is a community effort, you know, and we can work together to have awesome, fun events with each other that we'd prefer over spending our time alone in our rooms, right?
Yeah.
So that's what it's all about in the end, having more and more chances to come together and be active together.
Well, Joe has called in somehow. Joe, you've never had a mobile phone. How have you managed that?
Well, initially we didn't have any reception here and I've just relied on the landline. People have real trouble, difficulty acknowledging that, like the staff at work, when they wanted to text you if something was happening or if you were, you know, they'd say, oh, if you're away, do it text us. And I'm saying, oh, no, I can't.
But, do you take your landline phone with you to the coffee shop to pay for your coffee? Like, I'm just thinking about all the things I use my phone for, Joe.
No, I don't do any of that. I just go to places. Occasionally I'll ring up on the phone and book a restaurant, but it's the landline, of course. I was really horrible earlier this year because Southern Phone was cancelled all their landlines and I was like, what am I going to do? But then I eventually found another company that did do landlines, so that was good. I still have RACQ maps in my car, like those printed paper ones and the Refidex. I pay my bills by mail. I get all my bills posted to me. I go to Australia Post and pay some as many that I can. Or the Queensland Country Bank, you can pay bills. They'll pay the bills for you when you go in. So, yeah.
You live in that 1990s life, Joe. Thank you so much for the call. It's also perfect that you mentioned the Refidex, the street directory, because that is what we're going to talk about next on Life Matters. Before we move on to that, though, Goannis, I want to know, like, the Summer of Lud sounds like it was a huge success. Do you see yourself running another one again?
It was definitely a great success, and there will be more and more Luddite excitement in New York and beyond in the coming year. We don't know exactly what form it will take yet, but stay tuned. There will be more out there, I'm sure, soon enough. Also, I just want to kind of close by pointing out that anyone can do it, right? Anyone can sort of go out into public space and talk to a stranger or have a little event together that gets your mind and your body working in a way that maybe it doesn't get to so often. And you don't have to get rid of your phone right now. You don't have to throw it away. You don't have to destroy all of your technology. All you have to do is give yourself a chance, like the last caller, to have some of these extra interactions that are left on the table so often, to go talk to the person at the post office, to go walk into the restaurant in person and ask if there's space, right? These things that feel a little inefficient or maybe slower are often what bring us the most unexpected joy. So I just wanted to end on that note and thank you very much for having me.
Gowanus, Dan, thank you both so much. Gowanus, media spokespuppet for the Summer of Love. If that didn't make any sense, then go and listen to this full chat on ABC Listen later today when it's up. Dan Woodman, Professor of Sociology from the University of Melbourne. And thank you for your texts as well. It's not all roses, as I said before. One person says, my friend decided not to have a mobile phone of any type. Means he's always borrowing mine and asking me to book stuff for him. So annoying. However, one other person says, I refuse to move to an electronic calendar for my non-work life. My Week at a Glance diary is open on my kitchen counter. I refer to it during the day, add and tick off planned and ad hoc tasks. I don't need or want an electronic reminder about dinner tonight with friends. And another, like Ludd, I am a hand weaver. Today I am off to a knitting group for the morning, and this afternoon I will go to a museum with my spinning wheel. Woolly Wednesday. Love it. Well, we are keeping things extremely analog on Life Matters today. Coming up, when was the last time you got from A to B without relying on your GPS? What happens to our sense of direction when we stop using it?
One of the most ambitious projects in human history.
It's almost like the atomic bomb in terms of its transformational effect.
For decades, the breakthrough has been just around the corner.
That would bring our financial markets and electronic commerce to a grinding halt.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Join me for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, Wednesdays on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
When was the last time you used an actual map to find your way? Not the app on your phone, a physical, spread it out over your knees, turn to page 17 kind of map. It's been a while now, but for me, navigating used to be a point of pride. The cost of entry for sitting in the front seat when I was a kid was that you had navigation responsibilities, and I got pretty good at it. I didn't even have to turn the map as I went. These days, most of us get around using GPS. Australia has one of the highest per capita dependencies on satellite infrastructure in the world. And panelists at a space forum in Adelaide last week were asked what would happen if a solar flare took out our satellite infrastructure. The answer? We'd literally be lost without it, which is why emergency services and military personnel are still being taught how to read a street directory and navigate by the stars. But how would you fare if we lost satellite connection and had to rely on an old school street directory? Tell me, when was the last time you used a map or a compass? And in a moment, you'll find out what happens to your brain when you outsource your sense of direction to technology. But first, someone who regularly uses maps is Ian Jessop. He has been orienteering for 20 years. Hey, Ian.
Hey, good morning, Tegan. How are you going?
I'm good. So you are obviously out there using physical maps for orienteering. What do you see as sort of the big difference between a physical map and using a GPS?
First up, with a GPS, if I've got a map up on my phone with GPS, when I turn it around to face the direction I'm going, which you would with a physical map, the map that's on the screen turns around and it annoys the heck out of me. So if I'm using a paper map and I turn it to face the way I'm going, which is how you do it in orienteering, then it doesn't keep turning and spinning around. It's exactly how I want to read it. So I do find the GPS frustrating to that degree.
So you're obviously good at map reading. That's your hobby. But when you're in the car, are you using a physical map or are you using a sat nav?
These days I do use GPS, especially if you're traveling solo. If you're driving solo, you can just have it on the stand and have the instructions barked out to you. Obviously, we don't want to be looking at screens while we're driving, get in trouble with the police, etc. But I do find that it's much easier with GPS, although you do lose that sense of exactly where you are, because when you're using GPS, if you're looking at the screen, you're focused purely on the blue dot and where the blue dot's going. Whereas if you're using a street directory as a navigator, as you said when you were younger in the passenger seat of the car, you would be looking at the names of the streets as they come up. You'd look up in real life, you'd check the street sign. Yes, that's Johnson Street. That's good. The next one is Smith Street. That's good. We're traveling the right way. Mm. It's our second on the left next coming up. So you're using what you see in real life to validate what the map is telling you, which is how orienteering works if you're going the correct way. Whereas GPS, you are concentrated more on where the blue dot's moving than necessarily noticing street names or larger features such as a big church with a funny looking steeple or an unusual office block that you could perhaps use to use as a landmark.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking about the power of a paper map, basically, in the theme of today, our offline Life Matters. Jen says, I volunteer at a driving scheme to help young learners get their hours. It stuns me that almost 100% of the youth I take have no idea of very basic orientation skills like north, south, east or west. It stuns me. They rely on Google Maps and following directions. Well, I don't know if you remember, but there was a study of London cabbies and it found that the part of the brain used for memory and navigation was literally bigger in cab drivers than the rest of the population. So I'm really curious to know what happens to our brains when we start relying on GPS to find our way. Dr. Oliver Bauman is with me, cognitive neuroscientist, associate professor of psychology at Bond University. Oliver, do you use the street directory or GPS to get around?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I also use the GPS to get around, but I try at least the routes that I drive a lot to kind of being able to do them without GPS to have a bit more flexibility and independence, just for my own kind of self-esteem.
What happens in our brains when we're navigating or not having to actively navigate?
Yeah, so the brain region, the sort of hippocampus, which you referred to with the taxi drivers. So that would be then not involved as much in encoding the environments that we are in, because it really relies on focusing on landmarks, where we are relative to landmarks, and creating those spatial maps, which are then hosted in the hippocampus. And if you're just listening to instructions, then that brain region never gets to represent that specific environment. So we use it essentially less for that specific purpose then.
Not just in humans, science has looked at this in rats as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, there was one study where they also literally had rats on a little cart and they were driving them through the maze rather than having to run themselves. And then when they looked at their brain signals in the hippocampus, they could see that they had less stable representations of the environment. So there was still some representations, was a bit shaky. So you could imagine they would have difficulties or would make more errors as well, finding their way around. But the basic problem is that our brain, because it's so expensive, it uses roughly 20% of our energy intake per day. And so whenever possible, our brain tries to find the easiest solution. If we can do something without encoding a lot, then our brain will happily do so. So that's the kind of main issue at hand there.
So Oliver, the Space Forum that I mentioned before warned us that we're really reliant on satellite technology and that makes us vulnerable. Do you recommend that we take the time to exercise these navigation parts of our brains?
Yeah, I think it's good practice to at least, maybe when there's a bit more time available and on a weekend or for travel to really maybe have a look at the map and study where to go and trying to do it without the GPS, because I think it creates a sense of achievement to be able to do it without technology. So I think it's actually quite a rewarding experience. And then again, it builds up cognitive capacity for moments that you mentioned where, you know, the phone runs dry, that, you know, we don't even need solar flare, could be even just out of battery, and then we would have at least some fallback strategy to rely on.
On the text line, someone says, not just metropolitan street maps, topographic maps are no longer being produced and are getting harder to find, which makes map navigation harder in lots of remote areas where many online maps frequently don't work. So, Ian, I'm sure that's something that you've encountered. What tips do you have to get better at finding our way without relying on SatNav, Ian?
If you're traveling with someone, then when you're heading maybe to a sporting event or visiting someone for a barbecue or a social function, if you're traveling with someone, make note of the things that you go past on the way. So, like I said, distinctive landmarks. So, you know, a large church, a fast food restaurant, a particular sporting field or something, and just pay attention. Some people are quite happy just to go along and just go with the flow. Other people, like myself, might make a good spy, for example, interested in the surroundings. What's here? Oh, if we go somewhere that I've been multiple times with the family, I might go, oh, I think that's a new building there, or a new office block there, or a new residential block here. It depends. Some people are just simply quite happy to just go with the flow. Others are keen observers of their surroundings. I think it's always good to be interested in your surroundings and see what's where.
Yeah.
With all things, practice gets you better at it.
The power of paying attention. Ian and Oliver, thank you both so much. Ian Jessop, big fan of keeping up the skill of map reading. He does it regularly in his sport of orienteering. And Dr. Oliver Bauman, cognitive neuroscientist and associate professor of psychology at Bond University. Thanks for your texts too. One says, pet hate, people stopping in the middle of the footpath or in a building entrance while they check Google Maps. And another, I walked around Rome not using my phone GPS. What a joy. I walked in wonder, curiosity, attention, and connection to a place I do not know. It just brought so much awe and pleasure at pondering at corners of streets where I'd see something I wasn't expecting. Well, it is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, the University of Melbourne has just got its hands on a rare copy of the world's first guide to witch hunting. What can a 500-year-old book teach us about how dangerous ideas spread?
Do you know the next Australian of the Year? Are they running? Or raising funds for those in need? Building a house? Or building a brighter future? Conducting research?
Dementia is a national health priority.
Or making a life-changing discovery? Another day at work? Or inspiring future astronauts? See them, hear them. All you have to do is nominate them at australianoftheyear.org.au.
If I asked you to picture a witch, I think I could make a pretty good guess as to what pops into your head. It's a wrinkly, scruffy old woman. Maybe she has a big nose. Maybe she looks very evil. The question is, why is that the image that we all seem to conjure in our brains at once? Well, it has a lot to do with one book, Malleus Maleficarum, The Hammer of Witches, the world's most famous witch hunting book, written more than 500 years ago, and it shaped the way Europe imagined, hunted, and executed tens of thousands of women. And the University of Melbourne has just got its hands on a rare copy. Even though it's 5 centuries old, my next guest says it feels eerily relevant today. What made this book so powerful, and what does it tell us about how dangerous ideas become accepted by ordinary people? Well, Dr. Charlotte Miller is a senior lecturer in history at the University of Melbourne, who's also written a book about witch hunts. Charlotte, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about Malleus Maleficarum.
Yeah, I mean, it's so exciting that we have a copy. We have a copy from 1494, so it was published in the 1480s originally, so a really early copy. And this is a book that was printed and circulated really widely and was printed just before the witch hunts in Europe really took off, and it had a huge impact on what happened.
So this is a really early copy. Do we know how many copies would have been made?
Yeah, we have rough ideas. We think that at least 30 were printed by the end of the 16th century, which doesn't sound like a lot now, but is a lot for the time. It was originally written in Latin, but it was very quickly translated into German, French and Dutch. So that's another way it circulated. But I think the thing that's really interesting about this book from that perspective is that, so there had been witch hunting manuals before, but they had been handwritten. And this is really the first one that is printed. And so it's able to be circulated so widely and allow those ideas to really spread and take hold.
Mass media at the beginning. There's so much I want to ask you about this book. I'm absolutely obsessed with it. But before it was published, what was the idea of a witch?
So it's published in the 1480s, and this is kind of a transitional period between the medieval and what we call the early modern world. So in the medieval period, they definitely believe in witches, but during the 15th century, people start to become worried that there's a new form of witch who's in league with the devil, who's a sort of conspiratorial figure. So that the idea that the devil's kind of recruiting men and women at this period to be witches and to do evil deeds. And then the Malleus comes along and it says that these people need to be taken seriously. This is a threat. And that also these people are much more likely to be women than women or men as well.
Okay. So this is where the female witch idea comes from. Why do you think that idea was so appealing?
So what they do, what Heinrich Kramer, who wrote the Malleus, what he does is he brings together hundreds of years worth of misogynistic ideas about women. And these ideas aren't new in and of themselves, but the way in which he puts them together and he spends chapters and chapters on it is really vitriolic and really aggressive. So he basically says there are two main reasons that women are more likely to be witches. Firstly, that they're inherently evil, and he backs that up with biblical ideas of Eve as the sort of original evil woman. And he says also they're inherently credulous and not very intelligent, so they're more likely to be tricked by the devil. And I think because he's drawing on ideas that come from classical teachings as well, these ideas are already circulating, and he puts them in a framework that people are sort of already predisposed to believe.
Why was he so obsessed with women being witches?
It's a great question. I mean, so Heinrich Kramer was an inquisitor. He was a celibate monk, which is slightly interesting, I think. He, in the 1480s, just before he wrote this book, he attempted to try a woman for witchcraft. He attempted to allege that she was in league with the devil, and basically he was laughed out of court. People didn't take this seriously. They didn't believe that witchcraft was a real threat, and they just didn't take him seriously. And then he basically has to leave that town. And so he goes away in a lot of anger, I think, and very quickly writes this very long book. He also gets an endorsement from the Pope, which he puts at the front of the book, that says you need to listen to Heinrich Kramer. He's right about the witches. But he really is convinced that women are just evil. I think he refers to them as a necessary evil. He goes on, he thinks they're people we have to live with, but they're inherently dangerous.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, getting schooled by Dr. Charlotte Miller, Senior Lecturer in History at the University of Melbourne, the university which has just acquired a 500-year-old copy of Malleus Maleficarum, The Hammer of Witches, the most famous witch hunting book, basically the book that taught us that witches are scary women, and it led to a huge witch hunts that led to tens of thousands of people, mostly women, being killed over a couple of centuries. Charlotte, why did people pay such attention to this book?
Well, I think because it does circulate so widely, but also because it's not meant to be a theoretical text. It's meant to be a handbook. So it's meant to actually give instruction on how you can hunt witches. So, for instance, it advocates for the use of torture. I think we think that people in the past just tortured whenever they wanted to, but that's not true. Torture had to be justified. It was actually illegal in a lot of cases. So Kramer argues that witches are real and that you need, because this is such a dangerous crime and it's so hard to prove, you need to torture people so they will confess to witch hunting. And so he gives sort of instructions on how you do this, how you apply the torture, how you should interrogate women as well. And then also the copy that the universities acquired was published by Anton Koberger, who was a very important Nuremberg printer. So he was someone that people paid attention to, what he was sort of circulating. Of course, the papal endorsement is sort of the ultimate celebrity endorsement. The Pope says, this book is important. You have to read it. But but also there's a lot of visual imagery that comes out of it. So the book itself is not illustrated, but it's influential in the way in which artists start to depict women. So they start to depict, witches. So they start to depict witches as women, often as sort of the haggard old witch that we might think of, but also sometimes as young, voluptuous, kind of seductive women. And the idea there is that you think these women are sort of innocent, but actually they're evil and they're trying to seduce you. And so those images also spread quite widely as well.
It's amazing how pervasive these ideas are. So I am getting texts that I won't dignify by reading out loud about a former state premier being compared to a witch. This idea is still very relevant.
Absolutely. And we see that both in Australia and in the US and overseas as well. It's always something that is levied at female politicians, never as male politicians. Male politicians instead are subject to witch hunts, which is sort of interesting language, I think. But we do seem to think of the witch as is inherently female and also sort of the worst thing you can call someone, which is interesting when you think that, I mean, it's really quite horrible when you think that these are people who were tortured and killed for something they never ever did, and we still think that that's okay as a term to throw around.
What does this book teach us about how societal fears can spread dangerous ideas?
I mean, I think it's interesting if you sort of think about the start of print and the internet as well. I think they're quite comparable. So the start of the printing revolution transformed Europe. It meant that information could spread so much more quickly than previously. And it meant that these ideas were copied. So we have lots of other books that verbatim copy sections of the Malleus and then reprint it and circulate it. And so that information becomes much more sort of the source of truth when it's in multiple different forms. And I think we see that with the internet as well. One idea can spread and it's hard to see where the original idea came from, but it spreads out so quickly. And also it's because it's sort of drawing on ideas that people already had but hadn't articulated, there's a sort of willingness to believe it as well. And I guess the thing with witches is that they're so much more scary than a lot of other things, because the witch is actually sort of the danger within. It's your neighbour who's been a witch for 20 years and you didn't know. So it's kind of a much more intimate danger than perhaps an outsider fear as well. And I think that really scares people.
So ancient book, you're obviously excited to read it because you're a historian. What do you hope modern audiences get away from it?
Well, I guess first with our students, we're really excited that they actually get to see it after hearing about it for so long. I'm excited to show, 18, 19, 20-year-olds that text is still important, that not everything is online. So this copy, for instance, has annotations by the owner. And so we know we're going to look at those annotations and see, well, what did that person care about? What mattered to them in that book? So this copy is completely unique. But I think also more broadly, when we're talking about it, and we're going to give a few talks about it, that these ideas, just important to know that you can have little ideas from just one man, really, but if they get the right momentum, they can spread and they can have devastating consequences that people don't question for a very long time. So I think that's applicable to a lot of things today.
Charlotte, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Dr. Charlotte Miller is a senior lecturer in history at the University of Melbourne. She's also written a book about witch hunts. And if you would like to see this copy of Malleus Maleficarum for yourself, it will be on public display on the 10th of September in the Balliol Library at the University of Melbourne. Thank you for your texts as well. Jen in Warwick says, I think warlocks were represented as more powerful than witches. Misogyny in action once again. And Mary in Glebe says, we as a society need to reclaim the word coven, a group of wise women conferring. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Well, that is just about it for today. I've come to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow on Life Matters, we'll talk about sex ed in schools. Teachers say it should be part of their remit, but that they're not given the training for it. And I'd love to know what kind of sex ed you got at school and whose job you think it is. Thank you also for your texts today. We spoke at length earlier about Luddites, and I have loved reading your texts. A young woman in Sydney has started the Analog Society, meeting every few weeks without phones. Bring along materials for stitching, writing, collaging, magazines to quote-unquote scroll through. A great morning spent meeting like-minded people. another texting in off my flip phone. Before we all had full smartphones, there were heaps of semi-smartphones around with internet and ability to download apps. I switched back after burning out and it's completely manageable. I can do all the apps on this phone, but it's slower, smaller, and more annoying to scroll on. I completely agree, resetting new norms. Culture is created by people. Chris says, I'm living more of an 1890s life. My most recent acquisitions are a 200-year-old blacksmith's vise and a 100-year-old coffee grinder. No updates and they don't break. And one more. My little piece of resistance is when I'm chatting with friends or family and we can't think of that song or name of actor, I ask people to resist Googling and letting their brain cogs start working again. It will come to them when they're thinking about something else. It's quite exciting when we can recall it manually. Well, that's it for Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.